I'm going to tell you a little bit about what magnetic resonance can do, because it's a very strange technique in the sense that there's so many different variants of it, and it must be very confusing to a non-NMR person as to what this technique is. I mean, I know I've got NMR colleagues like Julia here and so forth, but I hope you won't be insulted. I'll just take a few moments to tell you about that method. And I'm going to say something about the way in which velocimetry works by NMR, which is kind of interesting, and you have to be aware of that in order to understand what we're doing. Before I get into surfactant, I'm going to do this, and this is sort of by way of an interaction between Tom and I too, because the polymer melts thing is not what I'm supposed to talk about this week. But of course, that's classically a shear banding system, which doesn't show shear banding. I mean, Doy Edwards predicts shear banding, but it doesn't. This system doesn't show shear banding, so it's actually quite sensible to start with that. And then I'm going to talk about two systems. One is the CTAB system, very close to an isotropic pneumatic phase transition, which was published last year. And then there's some recent work. We've gone back and looked at this sort of canonical system that Jean-Francois talked about, and we've been, over the last year, been trying to look at that in a little bit of detail and see what's going on there. So this is unpublished work, and I'll say something about that as well. So magnetic resonance. The nice thing about magnetic resonance, we know exactly what the nucleus is measuring. There's no question. We know the spin Hamiltonian, and we know all the terms there. It's a question of interpreting afterwards what that means in terms of the molecular host behavior. You start with a leading term, which is the Zeeman interaction. This is the overwhelmingly dominant term, the order of hundreds of megahertz, and that's what's produced by the polarizing field. And there's lots of other little terms here, which are small perturbations, but which give you this rich molecular information. So this gives you the Larmor frequency, the fundamental frequency on which to superpose all the extra information you want. And, you know, chemists use these two terms here. This is the term that comes from electron shielding, gives you the chemical shift, gives you these different lines in the spectrum, and then there's the scalar spin-spin coupling term, which tells you about proximity of nuclei. So chemists can look at this and tell structures, okay? So I'm not going to be doing any of that, but we can do that if we want to. We can see what molecule it is, but we probably know by reading the bottle, which to a physicist is good enough. You know? Now, what we're really interested in, what I'm talking about today, in addition to this term, which we'll use for position and velocity encoding, velocimetry, this main term here, is these two terms at the end. And these are terms which are dependent upon orientation of bonds and orientation of nuclei with respect to each other. So the quadrupole interaction for spins greater than a half can give us information about orientational order for the bond containing the nucleus, because the local molecular orbital has an electric field gradient, which gives you a principal axis system, which is aligned in some direction with respect to the magnetic field. Because the magnetic field dominates everything, everything's projected onto the magnetic field as sort of a first order perturbation. The dipole-dipole interaction gives you information, internuclear information, about orientation there as well. So, but I'll be talking mostly about entirely about the quadrupole interaction in terms of orientational order. So that's the story. And we can get average order parameters, and from the fluctuations in the orientation, we can get information about relaxation, molecular dynamics, and so on. Now, coming back to how do we localize, how do we get positional information? Well, what we do is we apply the magnetic field with an additional gradient term, so that's easy to do. That means that Larmor frequency becomes dependent upon position. And so that means that when you start to stimulate the spin system, you produce an isochromat of spins along some axis of the gradient. When you put that magnetic field gradient on, your Larmor precession frequency is position dependent. So you wind up a helix of phase in the spin system, and there's a characteristic wavelength which gets shorter and shorter with time as you apply that. And so there's a natural wave vector there, and the signal you acquire is the sum of all signals from all these isochromats weighted by their local density and their phase factor. And you can see there's a simple Fourier relationship. So if you simply acquire the signal in K space and inverse Fourier transform, you get an image. And that's my head. It's my actual head. See, rather old now, it was taken in 1988, but that's brain. My brain. Yes, it's my brain. I have seven slices taken through my brain. So it's there. Now, but you can also do things like Couette cells, you see. Yes, well, I won't dwell on the brain, but anyway, you see, you can do it with high spatial resolution as well. And you can do things like, I mean, this is not actually a wide-angle cell, this is actually a 4-degree cell, but you can blow up the gain in certain directions, and you really look in there. So you can do microscopy with this technique, and that's the game we play. Now, the other thing we do is we measure motion. And the way to measure motion is you do the same thing as you do with position, but you do it twice in a difference mode. So you create a spin echo where you first of all wind up a helix of phases, then you invert them all and unwind them again, and you produce a perfect echo, unless molecules move in the intervening period. If they move, then they carry, and they move with respect to the gradient direction, they carry the nuclear spin to an asynchronous part of the helix, so that when they rewind, there's a phase difference. And that phase difference now, in that difference mode, gives you information about displacement. So again, it's simply a Fourier relationship, it's a sum of phase factors in the echo amplitude. There's another wave vector here, which is conjugate to the displacement. And so it's just like the incoherent fraction of inelastic neutron scattering. It's exactly the same term that you're picking up here. There's an equivalent scattering wave vector. It's a formal equivalence between the way in which you measure this average of phases. You're getting a Fourier image now, not of the spin density, but of the probability of displacement over a certain time, some propagator or whatever. Very different length scale than neutron scattering, however. If you're measuring diffusion, you might be measuring some Gaussian that spreads with time. If you're measuring flow, it's a displaced Gaussian. So that's the idea. And so what we do is we do a double encode for Q and K and we get a multi-dimensional data set, and we get all the information out about position and motion.
So which is Q and which is K?
Q is the encoding for displacement, and K is the encoding for position.
They're both just Fourier.
They're both Fourier relationships. So we have to do a Fourier transformation in K space and a separate Fourier transformation in Q space. So for every pixel, which is the result of Fourier transforming in K space, we now have to do a Q space transform to get the probability distribution of displacement. Okay? And so this is the sort of apparatus. You have an NMR machine, just like you'd see in any NMR lab, but you have to do extra things. You have to have a motor drive and a shaft and the little cells. We actually manufacture these and sell them, so you can buy them from Bruker Scientific and Bruker through us. We make them, but Bruker sell them. So it's just a little advertising plug. So what happens now is that, you know, there's a pulse sequence. If you're not an NMR specialist, it doesn't mean anything, but basically for any pixel in the image, we will get this P of Z, this probability of displacing, a molecule displacing in the characteristic encoding time, which is on the order of milliseconds, or tens of milliseconds. And there it is. So it's a displaced Gaussian, has a certain characteristic width, which if we weren't truncating the acquisition and didn't have the sync modulation here, we would have a diffusive broadening, and the displacement would give us the velocity.
So Paul, just to reiterate, Q and K are different because they live at different length scales.
They live at different length scales. Exactly, K is exactly. Q is for the displacements, and there's the separate encodings that are all going on within there. It's a multi-dimensional encoding. That's the game, see? And so therefore, at every pixel, we go in the computer, we analyze, we look at this thing, we say, find the peak of the distribution, see how far offset it is. That gives us a velocity, pop that number in that pixel. And there's the map, you see. So you can see there's a color scale, positive velocity, negative velocity, nice uniform distribution, cone and plate, uniform velocity gradient. When it's well behaved. Exactly, the thing's going around like this. So this is the velocity direction, gradient direction, vorticity direction. Yeah? So it's a slice. And we can select a slice of any thickness we want. Typically it'll be a millimeter or something and a 15 millimeter diameter cone and plate.
What kind of granularity is there in your measured
velocities? Well, this is 128, plus or minus 128 pixels here. So there is some granularity there, because if we don't use our full dynamic range, there's going to be some sort of digital coarsening there. But we can choose a bigger number of pixels. It's only a question of zero filling. But in reality, we have a finite number of Q encode steps, and we typically use a minimum of 8, but we can go up to say 64 or 128 if we want to. It takes more time then. And the point about this distribution is we acquired over the time it takes to get this multidimensional data set, which is on the order of 15 minutes to half an hour, and bad cases, 2 hours. So this is an average. So you know, we're continuously encoding for all of K space. We're not scanning in position with time. We're getting all positions at every acquisition, because we're acquiring in reciprocal space, and we're also acquiring the whole of Q space over this time. So we don't know what's happening over that time, except that's an average. But there is a characteristic time scale, which is the time of encoding here, and I'll show you why that's important in a moment. It's very important. There's a time scale of the whole experiment, which is like half an hour, And then there's a time to actually encode for the displacement, this capital delta, which is on the order of 10 to 100 milliseconds. And I'll show you why that's...
Is that capital delta you use with the peak?
Exactly, exactly. That's the probability of displacing over that time there between those two pulses. That's right.
I have a question about the image. Should I be worried that the contours are horizontal and not span?
No, you should not be worried that the contours are horizontal. That's what they should be. We should have an increase in velocity from zero at the plate to a maximum at the cone. And it should go linearly up this way.
Okay.
So if I take a derivative,
yeah, yeah.
I get a uniform shear rate on both sides.
Is this a free surface?
Free surface at the edge, yes, that's right. Yeah, well, it has to be bounded because we have to contain the fluid. So there's nasty things going on out there, of course, as there is in any cone and plate. So, you know, this is the system that's well known. We did this some years ago. This is the Rehager and Hoffman system. There's no sodium chloride here. This is the unscreened system, rather peculiar one. Below the critical shear rate, well behaved. You see, we take a vertical derivative here, but when we go above the shear rate, a critical shear rate, well onto this plateau, we see shear banding. And this was the case where we saw shear banding bang in the middle of the gap. We never understood this, but there's a paper by Ron Larson that came out last year where he explains this as the virtue of secondary flow. Now, okay,
from the picture, can you say what the difference in shear rates between the center and the?
Let me go back. Can I say what the difference in shear rates? Yes, I can. We can profile it. I mean, we can. There's the profile there. That's the shear rate profile from 83 degrees to 90 degrees in a 7-degree cone, and as we increase the average shear rate, and this is strain rate control. We cannot do stress controlled. We don't have a stress transducer on our system. We can always strain rate controlled. We drive across there, and there's a sort of a bang of a lever rule. In other words, the maximum shear rate we observe remains the same, but the proportion of fluid in that band gets bigger and bigger. Now, the maximum shear rate we observe is sort of here, and we just don't know where the upturn on this thing is. We're not quite sure, but it's sort of a lever rule. But I want to come back to this time scale I mentioned and something about these probability distributions. Now, in some fluids, and Mike was referring this morning to the fact that we found that depending on the source of acetylpyrrolidinium chloride, we got different shaped shear banding. This was a different source material that had a very narrow shear band in it. Let's look at the probability distributions we measure in pixels just across the band. So here's the black part's the band here. There's obviously the line at the top's just the cone surface. So the black part there and the white part there is a band. It's in one pixel in this particular image. So if we go above it, we see a nice, well-defined velocity distribution. But notice just on the band here, and just on the other side of it, there's two peaks, you see? So what that's saying is that that pixel here was, according to our algorithm, giving us zero velocity, but there was, at some stage there, a finite velocity. So that band is either a finite width or it's been moving around. Now, in fact, we know it's been moving around. Sorry, Peter, you're looking...
Sure, I'd be worried about in the bottom picture.
Yeah.
This corrugation that's going
on. Oh, no, the corrugation's for the following reason. We have 8 Q encoding steps, and we don't drive the signal to zero intensity because which would normally happen if we went out to sufficiently high Q, which means we're getting a truncation in the FT, which gives us a convolution with a sync function. So we live with that because, after all we're interested in is where this peak is. We're not trying to analyze its width or its shape. Now, later on, I'll show you some propagators or probability distributions where we've gone to 128 Q encoding sets. We've really got beautiful probability distributions, and you'll see that there's a lot more structure than we see here. This is quick and dirty because we want to take half an hour or 15 minutes, not 2 hours. Mm-hmm.
This is velocity.
So this is the gradient map. This is the velocity gradient map. But the actual velocities from which we calculated that velocity gradient map came from probability distributions, which are shown here. And you can see these things are rather complicated.
But this is average over some time.
This is average over half an hour or so.
But I'm a bit confused by an apparent zero velocity peak in the band.
Well, isn't that right? That's what it's saying. That's the zero velocity side. That's the high velocity side. But sometime that band was a little higher up.
Oh, I see. Okay, yes.
Now, the way we know that band's migrating, because we can do this cunning little experiment where you encode and unencode So you're keeping your magnetization alive, the spin coherence is still there, but you do your encoding for displacement, and then you wait a period of time, and then you reverse encode. So what that's like is unwinding all the flow. So if the flow has remained steady state, you get a null result. And you can change this exchange time. So if you do a very short wait before you unencode, you get a null. But if you wait for about 80 milliseconds and do it, you get a disturbance, which is telling you the velocity must have fluctuated over that period of time. So you see, we can access very short times. That's great if we get it within that range, but we can't. But beyond about a second, we've had it because the spin coherence has died because of relaxation effects. We can tell nothing from a second out to about half an hour. But if it's under that time, we can look at, use NMR timescales to look at fluctuations. So we know that band was fluctuating with a correlation time somewhere between 7 milliseconds and 80 milliseconds. All right? Now, I'm going to take a digression and tell you, because I just want to show you some of the things we can do in terms of ordering in these fluids, and I want to tell you about a classic problem which you all know about, polymer melts and normal stresses and shear thinning and all that stuff. And the challenge here was to measure the complete alignment tensor of a polymer, entangled polymer melt at a range of Debra numbers or Weissenberg numbers, whatever you prefer. So here's the basic picture. You take a Kuetz cell and you know there's a deformation of the molecule that occurs under stress, under strain, rate of strain. There's a principal axis frame for the molecule. There's a hydrodynamic frame, the x, y, z axes. And in Doy-Edwards theory, a very important parameter is this orientational tensor here, where you look at the correlation of vectors on the chain. And through the stress optical law, that gives you the stress, you see. So this is the alignment tensor. Now, in NMR, we can measure that because we can measure this tensor directly, but we can only measure it projected onto the magnetic field. If we put a deuteron probe in there, the quadrupole interaction gives us precisely that orientational tensor, but projected onto the magnetic field. So if we want to get all the elements of the alignment tensor, we've got to play funny tricks with our Kuetz cell, a sort of a goniometric type analysis. So, you know, you go from the molecular frame into the hydrodynamic frame, that's the standard sort of stress tensor with its off-diagonal elements as the shear stress. But we get have to project that into the Zeeman frame, and we pick up one term there. So the game...
Basically rotating...
I'll show you how we do it. It's a cunning little trick. We have two cells. One is a vertical Kuetz cell. That's dead simple, because now the vorticity direction's along the field, so that gives us SZZ. Whatever we measure is SZZ. Okay? In this cell, we have a horizontal Kuetz, and the horizontal Kuetz now we'll have here the magnetic fields like that, here the velocity directions along the magnetic field, here the gradient direction on the magnetic field. So here's the trick now is to do NMR spectroscopy spatially localized. So this is where the sort of really tough spin mechanics comes in here. We've got to dig out the signal just from there or there, and just to, that's where all the hard work comes. And we've developed techniques for that. See, here's an example. We've got this little encoding sequence here which will destroy all magnetization outside the wanted region, store the magnetization in the wanted region. We can follow that with any experiment we like. So here's an imaging experiment, and that tells us the only spin magnetization that's alive to be performed, an experiment performed on, is there, which is the velocity direction along the magnetic field.
So in principle, you can scan?
In principle, we can scan. We can do both. There's two different ways. One is called, that's right, you can do imaging or you can do selective excitation or selective destruction. Yeah, that's right. So there's alternatives there. This is a very inefficient way if you want to get an image, but you can do it, you can go point by point. So, and what we get, we put on a small probe molecule in there. We put a deuterated benzene molecule, below 10%, insufficient to plasticize it. Sorry? The benzene molecule inherits some of the orientation order of the host. It's because it's sterically hindered as it collides with the polydimethyl siloxane. It cannot sample isotropically all orientations because the polymer chain gets in the way. It's not attached. No, it's a free probe. It's diffusing. And furthermore, over the characteristic time, it's diffusing many chain lengths. So it pulls out a complete average orientational tensor element, okay, averaged over microns of length scale. So it's getting it's sampling every possible location on the chain over the time scale. If you label the polymer chain with a deuteron, that'd be a totally different experiment. You'd be getting a local probe. You're measuring just at that position. But the benzene molecule diffuses and picks up the true ensemble average of all vectors on the chain. And we can check from the rheology that it doesn't change the rheological behavior of that material. So we get a splitting. It's very small. It's only a very weakly inherited order. It's way, way down in percentage. And we don't know how big it's going to be. There's like a stress optical coefficient that we don't know what it is. But having got it, well, then we can normalize to that and we can get out what happens in terms of the dependence on the strain rate.
Now, Paul, are you... The danger here is that it might not inherit all the distributions isotropically in the chain. When you're this benzene ring, you've got the chain also has some local...
Yeah.
Local anisotropy to a bond.
Yeah.
Can you convince us that the that there's a stress optical coefficient and not a stress optical tensor relating the orientation of the benzene molecule population?
I think I could, but I don't want to do it right now. But it's a very good question. I have to say it's...
Can you devise an experiment to show that?
You have a look at this experiment, see if you believe it. Okay, so we can go around, and furthermore, we can get SXX, XYY, SZZ, and we can get SXY because we do the rotational transformation in that plane there and do all the way around, we get a superposition of terms, and we can pick out this one by the appropriate analysis. So,
in principle, you could resolve that by doing it with two different species.
Yes, exactly. Look, we've done...
Shape of the tensor up to a scale factor.
If you go to an elastomer and deform an elastomer and put in a molecule like benzene, then put in something that's as highly biaxial in its shape, you get exactly the same result. There's no sense, and in fact, I can show you, I've done, you can do the analysis, you've got to go through the whole hierarchy of order, and the only order that matters is the last order at the highest length scale, which is the polymer chain that it's inheriting from. The probe molecule order doesn't matter. I can show you a detailed mathematical argument on that. Okay. In fact, Ed Smolsky and I are just writing a paper about that issue now concerning elastomers. It's quite interesting. But so that's true. So there we are. So we get the complete alignment tensor for the molecule as a function of shear rate, and this we can fit this with Doy-Edwards, and that's what the lines there are. And from that we can get a tube disengagement time, and from that we can get a Debra number, and we know the Debra number from Fittinger, whichever way you like to look at it, it's the same thing. And so you can see the classic failure of Doy-Edwards in that it predicts a peak in the shear stress, or the shear, the off-diagonal term of the alignment tensor, which drops down. And that would produce unstable flow and shear banding, but it's never seen, because in fact there's a plateau, and that's exactly what the data shows. Have a look at that difference there is interesting, because that's the biaxial nature of the deformation. When you stretch the chain, it doesn't deform, it doesn't shrink equally in the other two directions. So that's the second normal stress difference there that shows up. And Doy-Edwards gets it very nicely in terms of the data. We put convective constraint release in, and we've solved this problem, but this gets worse. So that's interesting. So this is a very crude application, the sort of Marici version of it. We just bung that in, and it does give us at least the right behavior there.
Is that really flat through the green?
No, it's dropping down. You can see it's dropping down.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a defect of that particular.
Yeah. Model. We're only getting out to a Debra number of about 10 here, but still, I mean, we can't. Our data just shows no sign of dropping at all, and I think the experiments show no sign of a.
So within the error bars on the green data, you're saying it's flat.
Yeah. The data's flat, for sure, as far as within the error bars. And then if you can just run round the angles here, you can trace out the whole curve. There's the splitting. And P2 cosine theta, which would be for a uniaxial deformation, is the solid curve here. And you can see the biaxial nature of the deformation very clearly there. And further, we can pull out the extinction angle. This is at a low Debra number, and the extinction angle is 27 degrees. And I checked. I had to go and see. It's 20 degrees, Tom. At on the plateau, okay? So that would be, in your language, 70 degrees for beta, okay? Which is just within your curve, I think. Yeah. So, and then we did the molar mass dependence, and there's some interesting things at high molar masses. We see slip occurring. There's a plateau of slip here, and it's completely reproducible. You get above about 800 kilodaltons, and we're up to about 80 entanglements here, so this is all very well entangled chains. There's a clear slipping, and Doy-Edwards no longer fits. It just, but that's because we can see the slip. There's the velocimetry there, you see. And we can measure exactly what the local shear rate is by velocimetry in the region we're going to fit, which is the slow Deborah number region. And from that, we can go and get the tube disengagement time for a range of molar masses, and it sits nicely on about an M to the 3.4 or thereabouts. So that's quite nice. Now, I'm showing you that story because I think it's sort of believable, and we're quite, it sort of makes us feel confident what we measure with NMR, it looks sensible. So when I show you things that are completely bizarre, you might feel a little better about it, or you might feel a little worse about it, depending on your point of view, you see. So this is like a sort of a confidence-building thing.
Well, could you just orient us with again, the concentration of polymer here and the...
This is melt, polymer melt.
Oh, melt.
This is melt. Polyamethyl siloxane from 300,000 molecular weight up to about 1.2 million, and that's 10,000 molecular weight is ME. So this is about, the lowest was 38 entanglements up to about 120 entanglements.
Substance transparent, flow biofringes data available.
I have done a very detailed literature search on flow biofringes, and I have to say there's very little, in fact, giving information about the stress tensor in flow biofringes.
Yeah, so, we're part of Northwestern, is there any guy I know who actually tries to get the flow off?
Yeah. There's very little. If you know of data, I'd like to see it, but I
was wondering, why don't you just deuterium mobile PDMS?
Well, there's a disadvantage there, because now we're not getting the ensemble average of S. We're getting the ensemble average of the spectra from all different locations, as opposed to the ensemble average of the interaction. So it's better to use a probe molecule. Now,
fill in the blank. What goes wrong if you average?
Well, if you have a deuterated chain, you're now getting a sum of signals from all the different chain positions, and each chain position has its own spectrum, which will depend upon where it is.
I get this. So it's like the dangling networks, the endmost segments give you a narrower line.
Well, we measure an average of exponential phase factors, right? Mm-hmm. What we want to get is the average of the exponent, not the average of the exponential function. Mm-hmm. And if you motionally average, you get the average of the exponent. Mm-hmm. If you don't motionally average, you get the sum of the spectra. Mm-hmm. So the probe molecule gives you the motional averaging you're seeking, because it's what Doy Edwards predicts. You could do the other experiment. It would be a different experiment. It would give you different information, and it would be a nice experiment to do. But this is, in a sense, a simpler experiment. Yeah.
And then just a minor digression for those skeptics. There's a very large literature on infrared dichroism of all these different labeled small molecules in elastomers.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember back when I was a grad student, I was up on that Mitchell and full strip and all this stuff. It's old, decades old.
Yeah. There's a heap of stuff on small molecules, in liquid crystal environments too, to measure all sorts of interactions there. So it's a standard thing in NMR to use these types of probe molecules. Anyway, so now back to surfactants. So this is the system that I was referring to at the start, which is the system very close to the isotropic pneumatic transition. It was studied by Jean-François and de Krupp and others in the Metz group. And here's the phase diagram. We're working a few degrees off the mixed phase region in the isotropic side, on the isotropic side of this IN transition. So we're starting off here, and we've done experiments at different temperatures and at different strain rates, and this is the one. We saw this flow curve, Jean-François showed us last week. It's a very nice flow curve. You can see a high shear branch there. There's quite a broad plateau from about 10 to several hundred, about a couple of 250 reciprocal seconds. It's flat. This is controlled stress. That's why it jumps across. And you can do it for different temperatures and so forth. Now, this is a system that shows wonderful flow birefringence. Okay. And so we've done NMR experiments at these positions here on the plateau under controlled strain rate conditions and at different temperatures approaching this transition. And you see that we indeed observe ordering. We are working with CTAB D2O, so we're using the deuteron in the water. It's inheriting the order from the micelles, which are presumably oriented in some way. it's a very weak inheritance because the fundamental strength of the quantum interaction is 100 kilohertz, and we're measuring about, what, you know, less than 10 hertz. We have to use a very cunning little two-dimensional method to dig that out. It's a very small signal, but it's there. And you can see that, it, sure enough, there's a transition from pneumatic to isotropic as you go across the gap from the outside wall to the inside wall. The dimensions of the cell we use are identically the same proportionally to the dimensions used by the optical people. It's a 1 millimeter gap, 17 millimeter inner diameter, 19 millimeter outer diameter, made of polyethyl aryl ketone. Anyway, so it agrees nicely. Now, the thing about this was we found that the shear band didn't correspond with the birefringence band or the pneumatic band. But one thing that was very nice was, and we saw this last week, that we agree completely with the neutron scattering in terms of the proportion of pneumatic as a function of shear rate at the corresponding temperature. And there's a funny thing about flow birefringence, but neutron scattering and NMR agree perfectly. So we thought, well, this is good because we're touching base with something which is important to agree with. Because when we see strange results, we're not allowed to be completely strange. You can be partly strange, but you can't be completely strange, otherwise no one believes you. So that's nice. But anyway, here's the velocity profile, and the problem is simply this, that where we have a pneumatic state, we see almost plug-like flow. So this is the velocity as a function of position across the gap. You can see it's on the line that passes through the origin of the cell. So that's what a rigid body would do. Okay. That's a zero strain rate. That is not zero strain rate. Not in the Couette cell, that is, yeah. And then there's something happens in between, and then we've got a very low strain rate out here. So that looks like a shear band. Now, if you look at these probability distributions of velocity at the inner wall and at the outer wall, they're well behaved. Pretty broad, but they're well behaved. We observed that in the middle here, they were ugly. I don't know if we published though, they're in the paper, but they are ugly in here. They're really nasty looking distributions, and the algorithm just blindly goes and finds it. We don't have to fiddle it, that's what comes out of this peak finding algorithm. So this is the velocity mode. The algorithm gets the mode, and it finds it. But it's funny. We know there's fluctuations occurring in there. And the strange thing is that that's pneumatic and it's not shearing, it must be a viscous pneumatic state. We know it's pneumatic. There's no argument. It's where the birefringent band is. It's what where we see the, and we do it in the same system, we're using deuterons to measure the velocity in exactly the same material.
So I tried to calculate this from the pictures, but I just can't figure out the geometry.
Yeah.
The one in the furthest, essentially zero velocity one out there.
Yeah.
So that actually has a finite shear rate because it's not.
Yeah, it's a finite shear rate.
Is that the same shear rate as the left-hand side of the cross belt?
I don't think our resolution is good enough to say that. I mean, it's very small shear rate here, it's very small there. We can't resolve that. I mean, we just don't have that. You know, there's a digital error here because we've got a finite number of pixels, and how accurately can we find that peak? And so, you know, we've got about a 2 or 3% error, statistical error on these points. We can't really say that precision.
It doesn't look pluggy. If it was pluggy, we'd have
No. We could actually blow up our velocity scale, our field of flow, if you like, to get a better resolution of that velocity. We haven't done that. These experiments are very time consuming.
On the shear rate curve,
yeah.
where are we on this?
Ah, that one there is, I believe, for the middle of the curve. It's this one. It corresponds to 40 degrees Celsius and 50 reciprocal seconds. That's where we are there. Okay, that's from memory. I can check that. I'm pretty sure that's true though. Now I'll show you. There's a complete set. If we fix the strain rate at 50, that's right in the middle of the plateau. And then change the temperature approaching the isotropic pneumatic transition. These are the set of curves. I'm sorry about the quality of the data, but you can see what happens. We get more and more pneumatic as we go across, close to the isotropic pneumatic transition. That's the proportion of isotropic to pneumatic across the gap. It's just showing that. And here's the velocity profile. It starts to spread out, you see? And if you look at the strain rates there, they're about 200 reciprocal seconds on that curve, which, if you recall, was very close to the high shear branch, which sort of started about 250 reciprocal seconds. So it sort of makes sense. We're getting roughly the right strain rate there. But you see that we have the band out from the wall, and we know it's pneumatic there. Now, the other curious thing, if you look in detail, you can see there is isotropic material near the wall. And the funny thing about it is that the phase of the signal, we've had to rephase those signals. We find that the relative phase of the isotropic and pneumatic signals, that's the NMR phase, is different. And that can only be different if they have different velocities. So let's propose the following, that sometimes the fluid close to the wall is isotropic and it's traveling at one velocity, and sometimes it's pneumatic and it's traveling at a different velocity. That's the only way we can explain why the phases of these signals, and this is after phase correction, are different. That's a subtle NMR point. We know that the isotropic and pneumatic signals are somehow picking up different phases, which could only be if they had different velocities.
Would you mind reminding us over which, since you are averaging the signal, just one pixel?
Oh, no. Okay. Well, no, in the vorticity direction, we're averaging over 10 millimeters. Unfortunately, the sensitivity requires us to do that. But we have that's 1 millimeter across there, and so in the gradient direction, we've got how many pixels? I think there's about 12 pixels across, and that makes 80 microns per pixel. Okay?
Can you, from the splitting, estimate the order parameter corresponding to the emitted phase?
Yes, because if we take the pneumatic state and measure the splitting, it's the same as the splitting we have here. So we say it's an order parameter of 1. If the pneumatic state has an order, whatever it is, whatever the order parameter of the pneumatic state is, that's what we see here. All right, there's no difference.
Okay.
It's exactly the same. And we never see that splitting change in magnitude. So the degree of order never changes here, only the proportion of isotropic pneumatic.
I have a question.
Sure.
In rod-like polymers, you have incrementally a little bit more rods. You go to the pneumatic phase, and it starts to get weighed down. If with temperature you tune into the pneumatic phase and you're fully in the pneumatic phase, is the viscosity known to go up?
No, the viscosity is known to go down.
That's
correct.
Yeah, exactly. That's what rods do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It's
completely opposite. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well,
this is kind of weird.
Weirdly oriented state.
I'm sorry?
Unless the pneumatic is in a weirdly...
Yeah, exactly.
State.
Yeah, I don't understand this.
Uh-huh.
I would prefer that it wasn't like this, but that's unfortunate. The data's being inconvenient here, and we have to try and explain it.
You've got the pneumatic order parameter, you know how the pneumatic is aligned.
Yes, we do.
It's the obvious direction.
Yes.
Is it aligned?
Yes. What happens is that it's a polycrystalline material, but the domains orient in the magnetic field. The magnetic field cannot orient the chains, but it can orient large objects like domains.
So it could go up if you have a magnetic field along the gradient direction.
No. Your magnetic field does not change the order parameter of a liquid crystal. Never.
It
changes
the orientation
direction. Can it be possible?
It can certainly change the orientation of large objects like domains, and in a very large rod-like object, like a PBLG, it'll actually orient the...
No, you can go to low molecular weight liquid crystals already.
Yeah.
Is the field along the axis?
The field in this case is along the vorticity axis, yeah. This is a vertical Corrette cell, vertical with respect to the magnetic field.
So if the pneumatic director points that way,
yes,
then I don't know what viscosity is when you're shooting it this way.
It's a little bit larger.
Yeah.
It's a little bit larger than the average.
Does the magnetic field win at these shear rates? There's 7 Teslas. So you're asking, is there...
Concrete magnetic
orientation.
Yeah. If we're orienting with respect to the velocity direction, then what we project on the magnetic field is P2 cosine 90, which is a half. We should get half the order parameter. And this is... I need to check this. I think when I say we are compatible with the pneumatic phase, I think that's taking that factor of a half into account, as I recall that. So,
in a lock rolling state, then the magnetic is in a lock.
I'll have to go back and check this because it's. But I'm pretty sure that it's the factor of 2 that we expect. In other words, we're oriented along the velocity direction, and when we're in the pneumatic state oriented with respect to the magnetic field, we have a factor of 2 there.
Okay.
I think that's in the paper.
The point is that if you have a pneumatic without a flow,
yes,
it's got big domains, and certainly 7 Tesla will completely align.
Absolutely,
but
and it does.
You don't know the relative aligning effect of a shear rate of 20 zipper-seconds and a magnetic field of 7 Tesla. A priori, you don't know...
No, we don't know it a priori. No, because you have to know the dynamic susceptibility.
As far as you remember, these actually It leaves the director pointing along the
street. It leaves the director pointing along the velocity direction, yes, the factor of 2 there.
If it was transverse, if it was along B, then it would be much...
No, it's...
Is the field enough to reduce the pneumatic phase at those...
No, the field cannot induce a pneumatic phase. It doesn't change the ion transition. System that's known, actually, any liquid crystal system. But all it can do, the field is it can change domain orientation, but it doesn't actually induce order. It's at a molecular level, or even at a micellar level, it's too weak. The Dianetic susceptibility to actually
order. The shear winds.
Yeah.
Shear winds, but it's static. How can shear wind if it's static?
How do you mean static?
The phase is moving like a rigid volume. Stress might be, but shear can't.
I think I'm missing something here, Mike.
You're objecting to labeling in terms of shear rate. Well, you prefer to see it labeled in stress.
Well, okay, but you said that in the region where...
Let's just go here. So we're at low shear rate. We're just hitting the top of the plateau. We see an isotropic behavior. Here we see the generation of a pneumatic phase, presumably oriented along the velocity direction.
Okay.
And that the proportion of that pneumatic phase grows across the gap with increasing shear rate. That's what we're saying.
Yes, but how fast is it moving?
How fast is it moving, or how much is it shearing?
How much is it shearing?
Well, 100 reciprocal seconds. Yeah.
No, the pneumatic part.
Oh, the pneumatic part. Oh, very.
You were saying before that part of that was kind of
frozen. Okay. The point of this is that we've got a result which is an average over half an hour. So what we posit is that fluctuations occur across the gap, and which generate pneumatic phase sometimes, which relate back to isotropic phase at other times. And what we're seeing here is the average over half an hour. Okay, so that's where the model comes in.
Well, can you go back one?
Yeah. This was changing temperature at fixed strain rate.
How would the NMR picture look like if the orientation would be along the magnetic field?
The magnetic field this way.
Rather than the flow direction.
It would be twice as big splitting. And I'm almost certain, this is from memory, that it's in our paper. We measured it in the pneumatic state, and we found a factor of 2 difference in the splitting compared with what we measured with flow-induced order, which is what you'd expect if the order was now along the velocity direction, projected P2 cosine theta along the magnetic field. Yeah.
I'm confused about the spatial tie-in between where the pneumatic is.
Yes, I understand.
And the velocity curve.
Well, I am too. But there's the pneumatic there. You can see it. There's the pneumatic. There's the isotropic proportions. So we have pneumatic here. Not 100%, 90%, and we still have 10% isotropic.
Yeah, as a time average.
As a time average, and this is a time average too. So it's just getting the mode. It's saying which of those two peaks, one at zero velocity, one at high velocity, won the battle of which was the highest. And here, the high velocity peak is winning that mode battle, and here the low one is, and there's a crossover that occurs there.
Is there anything?
But it's a time average.
Is there anything different in the way the material was sometimes at zero velocity and pneumatic? Say,
yeah. Because we're always on the isotropic side of the transition in this experiment.
But the way that the contribution to the P2 measurement goes is a function of velocity. Would you expect one? If it's a superposition of 2 phases, so going back and forth,
yeah.
Would you expect different motional narrowing from the different...
There's a characteristic time, which is the time of the quantum time, which is the time of the splitting. So if the fluctuations are fast compared with that time scale, and that's on the order of 10 hertz, so the time scale is 100 milliseconds, if the fluctuation between isotropic and pneumatic is happening rapidly with respect to 100 milliseconds, you get an average peak. You don't see 2 superposed spectra. And so the splitting will be some sort of a mean between the two. But if the fluctuation is slow compared with 100 milliseconds, as we know it must be because we see separate isotropic and pneumatic components, then we just see a proportion of the signal for when it was pneumatic and a proportion from when it was isotropic. So it's a characteristic time scale, so we know exactly what it is, and that determines the motional averaging condition. So it's slow, it's on the slow side.
But what you can't do is tie or kind of cross-correlate in some way the velocity and the
demand. That's what we can't do. It's a coarse time average over 30 minutes. And it's actually over 2 hours in this case, because we're using the deuteron to measure velocity with, and the deuteron's much less sensitive than the proton. So this is a 2-hour experiment, actually.
You sure you can't?
Yeah.
Well, no, no. The, of course we can. Of course we can. Of course there's a clever experiment we can do. No, no, I could think of it. I could think of it. And it, no, no, I can. I know how to do that. Yes, yes, there is a weird encoding. It can be done. It can be done. It's bloody hard to do, but it can be done, all right? Yes. Yeah, it can be done. And maybe that's what we need to do. But the, no, you're right. With NMR, it can always be done. Sorry? Sorry?
Four-dimensional.
Yeah, it's another dimensional. It can be done. But it may be there's a, the price you pay is a time price. You have to understand about NMR is an incredibly insensitive technique because the photon energy is so small, you're competing, the signal to noise is always a battle. So NMR experiments are always performed at the absolute utmost limit of whatever signal to noise is available. So as soon as you go to spatial resolution, you trade off signal to noise that you could use for spectroscopy. So it's a real problem. There's a brick wall you hit with sensitivity.
There's one other thing that's kind of troubling.
Yeah.
If we think back to when we were talking about the melts,
yeah,
those also show splitting,
orientational. Yeah,
splitting.
They did.
How do you know when your splitting is due to pneumatic order versus splitting that's due to orientation?
What's the difference? I've got an order parameter. You know.
Right. So I'm saying we don't know that this is pneumatic.
No, we don't know this is pneumatic. No, we don't know, but it, okay, if you go back to the...
It could be viewed as the second moment tensor of an isotropic...
To be fair, in the original phase diagram, it's described as a birefringent phase and an isotropic phase. So we say pneumatic, but strictly speaking, De Krupp and others who did this phase diagram called it a birefringent phase. So whether it's pneumatic, we don't know.
And is there a low viscosity birefringent phase?
Yes, it is a lower viscosity than, it is actually lower viscosity than the isotropic. That's correct. Right?
There is also an hexagonal phase, which is not, that's the reason why I put birefringent.
Yeah, yeah. This is your phase diagram. My apology, my sincere apology. I thought it was Sean Paul's, yeah. Okay. So now, let me show you something else. If you shear this thing and then turn the motor off and watch what happens to the spectrum, right? You just take the total spectrum from the gap. You don't need to spatially resolve anymore. This is what happens with time. The pneumatic peaks die out. The isotropic peak grows. So there's a characteristic relaxation rate for this thing to return to isotropic, which of course it must do because in thermal equilibrium it wants to be isotropic. It's a non-equilibrium state that we've generated here by the strain. So this starts one thinking. If it's turning off the strain rate causes it to relax back, and if the pneumatic state is a state of low strain rate, it's not going to stay in that state. If you generate pneumatic fluid which is not being sheared anymore, it's going to do this, the characteristic time. So that gives one the thought that shear rate creates pneumatic order, but pneumatic order will relax back to isotropic given time, and so there's a competitive process at work here. And that's the basis of fluctuations. Now, I don't feel totally comfortable with this model, but that's what the data suggests. And so we know that this viscous pneumatic material, because we see pneumatic material that doesn't shear, that's what the data shows us. So that means it's got to be here on the flow diagram somewhere. Maybe it's just this region here, I don't know. But let's just say that somewhere on this flow curve, this constitutive curve, whatever we want to call it, there's a branch that's pneumatic, and that underlying it we've got this sort of classic flow curve with a unstable branch and an upturn here. And let's think how that would translate to a velocity profile. First thing to understand is that in a Couette cell, the ratio of the inner to outer wall stresses is fixed, but we are strain rate controlled. So on this flow curve, if we have a logarithmic coordinate there, that distance is fixed, but it could be anywhere we like. It can roll up and down wherever we like. It's not, all that's got to be fixed is the integral across the gap to give us the inner wall velocity or the average strain rate.
What is the upper curve, the thin one? Is it the one from the pneumatic phase?
Well, that's what we call it, the pneumatic phase, yes.
But it's more viscous?
It's pipop. Well, look, I don't know whether it's up here or down there, and frankly, it doesn't matter at all in terms of what I'm about to propose. Not at all. Let's just say there's a pneumatic phase which is here or here, but it's certainly not there.
No.
Okay, so it's more viscous than that state. That's all we need. No. So that there's no, we've got no resolution in there anyways. You can see it's with Peter's question is what is the strain rate, you know, in that region where the strain rate was low. We don't know whether it's there or there. It doesn't matter. But you see, that would give us this velocity profile. At the highest stress, the inner wall, low strain rate, high strain rate here on the high shear branch, low strain rate down here. Something's going on. So let's have a model which says the following, that we start off generating pneumatic fluid at the inner wall. That pneumatic fluid is viscous and lies on another branch. That's the highest stress point. And the rate of generation of the pneumatic state is proportional to the shear rate, or the proportion of fluid in the high shear branch. So the more high shear, the more fluids out here in the high shear branch, the more greater rate at which we're generating this pneumatic state. Now let's say that once this pneumatic state is created, that somewhere along this branch, some fluid's going to want to drop back to isotropic. Now, will it drop here? Will it drop there? Well, it's at high stress. If it's going to go isotropic, it's going to jump to there. And so now we're going to have some fluid available up here at higher stress, and that's where the shear band will want to be. It won't want to be there anymore. It'll jump to the point of higher stress. All right, that's the argument.
Yeah,
no. Right, okay.
So okay. About
the 20% difference in stress. There's 20% difference in stress across here. This is up here. That's it here. Yeah, this is just a schematic here, right?
Normally, I don't see any reason why it has to bother to go out to this shear.
All right, well, it's going to go isotropic at that point. So what's it going to do? Where's it going to go? Well, it's at this stress, at this instant, and it's going to become isotropic. So at that stress, there's the fluid over there.
But it could just jump to the left-hand part of that.
Yeah. At constant stress?
Just go on. It can just go and carry on across.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, carry on. Come down to the corner. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Why doesn't it come down here?
Yeah.
Across there, and straight down there. Why does it bother to go right the way over there?
Don't know. let's just propose that it does this, shall we? I mean, you're right, who knows? And if it does that, that's where the shear band will want to be, because that can actually reduce the stress in the system. That'll end up giving us a lower stress. See? See what happens is that once that happens, the thing drops down. The stress drops down. So it reduces stress, and hence if there's less stress at the same strain rate, there's less dissipation. So that's what will happen. So here's the picture.
Is it a fixed torque or a fixed rotation?
Fixed rotation rate.
Okay.
It's always a fixed rotation rate. So here's the game. This is it.
So what do you mean?
Okay. So what's happening here is that we're generating fluid. Every time we have that, the red part is where the shear band happens to be. The curve here is a curve of one is pneumatic, zero is isotropic. It's the blue curve. So we're getting a profile across the gap of where the isotropic and pneumatic parts are. It'll cycle back to the start in a moment, and we'll see where the thing begins. It's a loop, and pretty soon we'll get the end of the loop. Just give me a moment. Okay, here we go. So it's generating, and we're creating pneumatic fluid, but suddenly it's going to relax back. Whenever it relaxes back, the shear band jumps down and the stress relaxes, you see? And eventually there's a steady state between generating pneumatic fluid and fluid dropping back to isotropic. So you see...
So you're saying that to make some pneumatic, you have to have the shear band.
You have to have the shear band, exactly.
And then it passes by, leaves a pneumatic thing, which you can't stay in.
Yep.
Because it's got to keep moving.
Exactly.
The shear band is always in the isotropic.
Exactly. Phase. Which means the shear band always has to move.
It's wake.
Yes.
Is pneumatic.
It's wake is pneumatic.
That to relax.
Yeah. So you can't have a steady state solution for the position of the shear band. So this gives us some predictions. This model will tell us, therefore, what average proportion of isotropic pneumatic there is at any position across the gap. And it'll tell us what the velocity distribution is at any point across the gap. And it will furthermore tell us that if we increase the shear rate, it'll tell us how the average shifts, because that changes the composition. We just put any numbers in we like for the relaxation rate of the pneumatic to isotropic and the rate of generation of pneumatic. But having done that, if we double the shear rate, we double the generation of isotropic pneumatic transition. So that will tell us what's going to happen.
How did you choose the width between the two? Between 5 and 3.5.
Yeah, this is totally schematic here.
Did you choose choose it so broad compared to the loop made by this the stress strain height curve?
The answer here it should be 0.23 on a log scale, on a linear scale. The ratio is 0.23 for the inner to outer wall. This is log to the base e, but this is just schematic.
Okay.
Sorry, one question.
Yeah.
Can you predict the curve on the right with the dynamics on the left?
If you knew the details of this, you could, I suppose. Yeah, I guess. But anyway, you can pick out this sort of, with this sort of competitive process, this sort of schematic behavior, you can get how you're going to predict an isotropic kinematic ratio which changes across the gap, and you can see how it will change as you change the strain rate at constant temperature. The dots are the data and the lines are the results of the simulation. Okay. So you see something, it sort of reproduces qualitatively what we see, which is that at higher strain rate, we have a higher proportion of pneumatic. But not to be taken too seriously, but we see the basic idea. And if you play with temperature...
The shear band is actually a bit wider.
That's not the shear band, that's the isotropic pneumatic.
Yeah, the width of the shear band is pretty much fixed by where you are on that platter.
Yes.
The pneumatic and the left-hand branch are close in viscosity.
Yes, exactly.
You've got this piece over here. So if you move to the right, you must have more of that.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of sweeping out more
absolutely.
At the time.
Absolutely.
It's all relaxing at the same rate, so you're going to get more pneumatic.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Exactly. And we have no idea what happens with temperature, but we can play with the variation of the pneumatic to isotropic relaxation rate dependence on temperature difference from the IN, and we find we need a sixth power in order to get something like the, which is pretty unphysical. I mean, I don't understand that. But there's some temperature dependence of the rate of relaxation. So
your current model, however, cannot transport the strongly pneumatic phase all the way to the outer
no,
cylinder.
The
data do seem to say it's getting there.
No, the data, we never see it completely pneumatic there.
So I just get back to those graphs. I just look at those graphs.
But you have a substantial fraction.
We've always got an isotropic.
Okay,
that's so the outer wall.
But you haven't gone all the way across the plateau.
Oh, we're pretty well there. It's 200 reciprocal seconds. We haven't gone to 200,
so
that's true.
So you don't understand the colored data points you were just showing us.
You don't? Okay, let's go back.
Because in that case, why aren't the blue, take the left-hand graph, take the blue.
The blue here,
polygons,
yeah.
Blue polygons going to zero at the right-hand, at the one.
There's a finite amount of pneumatic material found out at the outer wall. There is. Yes, there is. There is.
That's what he was trying to say, that there's pneumatic...
Oh, I see, I see.
The model doesn't actually...
Well, no, the model cuts down more rapidly than that. You can see the way the model cuts quite sharp, whereas this is a very gentle drop. So the model doesn't reproduce the shape of the data correctly. No, I agree. I mean, one shouldn't take this model too seriously. It's to get us thinking about competition between processes. That's all it's about. Now, let me go on to this other system to finish off. And I have a better simulation here using a Johnson-Siegelman type curve and using the proper stress difference and so forth, and we'll see some other things. Now, this is the system which is a long way from an isotropic pneumatic transition. This is the one that Jean-Francois told us about last week. It's acetylpyridium chloride sodium salicylate, 0.5 molar sodium chloride in D2O, 10% concentration, shows a shear thinning behavior with a flat plateau and so on. It's a classic Cates type, you know, single exponential system, nice, well-behaved thing. Birefringence not conclusive, I think. Is that right for the system? Yeah. Shear bands observed by NMR velocimetry. Now, what we've decided to do here is let's use the deuteron completely for this experiment. So we're always using the same material, the D2O system. Use a deuteron to investigate the ordering, to see if there's any ordering, because we're nowhere near an isotropic pneumatic transition here. Let's do the velocimetry by deuterons. Let's do a very, very careful analysis of the velocity distributions by doing lots of Q points. I think it's 6,428. I can't be sure, but we get very good velocity distributions. And we can also do proton NMR on the micelles themselves, because it's a deuterated system. We can see what are the micelles doing, and this is very preliminary. So we haven't published this yet, but I'll show you some data here. We do not see a splitting. What we do see is a slight broadening of the deuteron line, and that's the full width half maximum. So the deuteron line that's about a hertz, but near the inner wall, depending upon the shear rate, as we go just above the critical shear rate, just on it, to up about 50 reciprocal seconds, we see a broadening, and that tells us the order parameter has got to be, I was wrong the other day, Mike, you asked, I said it was 0.01, it's 0.1. It's actually, we know the water panel is less than of the order 10%. It can't be bigger than 10%. So we can't say there's no water there, but we see no evidence for water. We do see evidence of a broadened line, but that could be an effect of dynamics or relaxation, spin relaxation as much as ordering. Until you see a splitting, you don't know you've got ordering with NMR. There's no splitting observed.
Could you label it in like alpha position in the shale, the subtractant?
This is the deuterons.
Yeah, well, if you label the surfactant.
If we could label the surfactant, yeah. I'll show you the surfactant signal later, but that's done with proton NMR. We haven't got labeled surfactants. So we're working on the water, from the water signal, inheriting any order from the micelles that way. These are the velocity distributions. There's a whole set of them from the inside wall to the outside wall. Take two of them, they can clear. There's the inner wall, and you can see there's a little peak at zero velocity. So we do find there's some fluid at zero velocity occasionally at the inside wall. And the width of that propagator is exactly the diffusion width. It's the mean square displacement due to Brownian motion. It's what you'd calculate knowing the encoding time. And look how broad this is. It's hugely broader than the diffusion spread and displacements, and so this is highly suggestive of the fact that the velocity was wandering over that experiment. At any instant of time, the only thing that can broaden that propagator is the diffusion. And as we go to the mid-gap, we see a much more zero velocity. And you see the mode calculation here would give us a high velocity there, zero velocity there, and zero velocity there. But the fact is, even though the mode analysis, which gives us the shear band, says it's zero velocity, there's a finite probability of being out at other velocities there. So it's quite a complicated picture. And if you do an analysis of the proportion in the lower, in the zero velocity, even at the inner wall, there's always a finite fraction of zero velocity at the inner wall. So it must be occasionally completely slipping there as well. And if we look at the micelles themselves and the proton NMR signal, this is the pyridine head group, this is the cetyl chains, and this is the salicylate peak, and we've normalized onto that peak the area, so we're assuming no change, and it's a spin echo. So that means that if we see a change in intensity here, it's going to arise from a relaxation time change, which is associated somewhere with the dynamics. Now, we haven't analyzed this work yet. There's a possibility to get in there and see what's happening to the fluctuations that produce spin relaxation for the protons at these different locations. So there's something happening on the chain and in the head group which is different than the counter ion.
At what sort of time
scale? This is an echo, you're asking the echo time. It's the order of 20 milliseconds. So we're seeing there's a change in the relaxation time of the protons on the chains. And that's presumably associated with change either in ordering or in dynamics. Those two things can produce change in relaxation time. So this is an unfolding story. We don't know the answer to this yet, but we can do spectroscopy there. Now, here's the model. We've got no isotropic pneumatic transition to propose here. So what the hell is going on here? We know there's fluctuations because we see the broad distribution of velocity. So this is the idea. I've just been playing with this model. It's a log stress, log strain rate. Graph here. This is a Johnson-Sigelman light term, but only this second term here, I've chosen a lower power law exponent. You could do it with one, but I've chosen it with 0.1 because it just makes a flatter region here, just to illustrate this. In other words, it's a bigger spread in strain rates in this. If you think about this, the log of stress difference is fixed by the inner to outer radius here. If you look at the inner wall velocity, it turns out to be the integral of the strain rate as a function of log stress, d log stress. Okay, that's simple to show because strain rate is r d omega by r, so that's fine. So we have to keep that fixed. So what we're doing here is we're proposing that we've got the system dividing with exactly the right distance there for the gap of the cell we've got, which is 0.23 on the log scale, natural log scale. We're going to have some fluid on the high shear branch, some on the low shear branch. All we have to do is to keep that integral constant, and this thing can dance around wherever it likes. That's allowed to go anywhere it likes, as long as it keeps that distance fixed. So you can see what happens. If we start to slide down, we've got to have that region there's got to get bigger and bigger, because we need more and more of this fluid as it comes further down in strain rate in order to keep the strain rate at its fixed value. And so the mechanism is this. We start by the thing going to the top of the curve. It'll run up here. Some fluid will jump to there. and then the system can relax by just dropping down. So the time dependence here is that the system always wants to drop down this curve to lower the stress. And then it can't get further than the bottom. But then we'll, in the competitive process in the other direction, we'll have random jumps of this point here, this jump between the low shear branch and the high shear branch, somewhere else in the fluid. And if that point jumps somewhere else in the fluid, all that fluid below that jump point will drop onto the low branch. So that's the model. And so I'm going to now show you the simulation of that. And that's a MATLAB program, which is up here somewhere. And let's run it. We'll see it going. And what we have here is log stress, linear shear rate, log stress, log shear rate. This is the velocity profile across the gap, and this is the building up of the probability distribution of velocity. So you see here, there's the thing running down, and every now and again, this point will relax by jumping up. So there's a steady rate of drop down the curve, and in competition, there's a random jump of any point along that upper branch to the cut point to move further up. And so that means that what's happening here is this velocity profile in the high shear region is changing its gradient all the time. And it changes its gradient because as this runs further down the curve, it needs more and more of the fluid in the high shear branch to make up the average strain rate. When it's high up, it doesn't need so much. So that changes the position of this cut point here. And so you can see what's happening. We're building up a probability of being at zero velocity. When we're way up here, we'll have a very steep curve, and this chosen pixel will have zero velocity. But at any other point, we're going to get a distribution of velocities. And you can play this game by moving this pixel around from the inside wall anywhere you like in the MATLAB program, and you can generate velocity distribution. So there's no physics in this model at all, except that what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to explain this data. The data is extremely inconvenient, and I wish it weren't like that, but we do have this velocity distribution. So what would give us a velocity distribution with time that gave us a sharp peak at zero velocity and a broad distribution over a range of velocities that's higher, which shifts further out as we go closer to the inside wall? And this sort of picture does that. So I don't have any microscopic basis for this, but it's just that it's obeying the fluid mechanics in terms of conserving the stress ratio and keeping the average strain rate fixed. That's all it's doing, and it generates the picture. So I have no idea what the physics of this might be, but it does what we want. And that's where I wanted to stop.
There's a suggestion that there is no selected stress.
There is no selected stress, no.
Right,
no. That's right.
Any unsteady flow would have to obey the same kind of constraints as you have.
Yes, it would. It would. So any unsteady flow would do that.
Any mechanism for
that's true. That's true. Any unsteady flow.
And
that's right.
But any particular mechanism will presumably give you a different time average, unless somehow the shape of this curve is independent of the dynamic you've tried out.
No.
Don, once you have an unsteady flow, I don't see really why we have much hope to assume that it's spatially homogeneous. And once you've gone unsteady, why surely you'd have different unsteadiness in one half? In other words, you should break the axial symmetry.
Absolutely.
Which brings normal stresses into the equation.
Yes.
And
so, I see.
And unfortunately, then that takes you off this sheet. But actually, that's something which can you examine in your imaging? I don't know how many regions you simultaneously.
Yes, we can do the whole cell at once. We tend to actually select a row of pixels across the cell, but because we don't want to handle too big a data set.
Yeah.
But we've got the whole
system
there.
But because you're taking a two-hour average, whatever.
Exactly. And we're averaging down the vorticity direction, many gap diameters. Yeah.
Right. But you're not going to be able to decide whether the interface is at any given time at the same place.
Unless we do the clever NMR experiment that correlates some parameters and encodes them just the right way. Yeah, that's right. presuming such an experiment can be invented.
These pictures are quite impressive, but I'm somewhat worried about the alpha equal 0.1.
Well, okay, the reason, if I chose one, all it does is it brings this, it makes the thing more like that, yeah? But it's essentially the same behavior is there. As it drops down, this band has to get broader as it comes back on the flow curve because it needs to satisfy the average strain rate condition. So the essential behavior is reproduced there. Yeah.
So it jumps back much faster.
It jumps back, I guess so.
Because when you come over, you automatically occupy a large bunch of the smaller.
Maybe it doesn't spread them out. I haven't got that one going yet. I started with this one because I like the look of it, but I mean, it's a bit naughty. It's not a true Johnson-Sigelman type, which I only learned about, thanks to Suzanne Fielding last week anyway. Thank you for teaching me about Johnson-Sigelman fluids. I should have known that, but she encouraged me to... I'd actually just made up some numbers to make a flow curve, but, you know, like art, not science. So Suzanne persuaded me that I should use a model that other people could relate to. So thank you for that. I didn't quite get it right. Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you for very much.
Okay.
Yeah.